Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a resident, and in today's podcast, I will be continuing my series relating to the ABIM, so the American Board of Internal Medicine exam, or like the medicine in training slash step three. Okay, I will continue my review. So this will be series 9, and I'll be focusing on nephrology today. So let's jump right into it. Okay, so let's assume you get a question on the exam about, a person that is septic, right? So let's say you have like a 55-year-old female, she's septic, her white count is super high, it's like 20,000, and she's been hypotensive and all that stuff. And then they tell you that when she came into the hospital, her initial creatinine was like 0.9. And then, like 2 days after admission, it's 1.6, right? If you see that, what are you thinking about? I hope you're thinking about an AKI, right? An acute kidney injury. And what type would you think she'll most likely have? A person that has had like hypotension and sepsis and all that stuff. I hope you're thinking more about like a perinal AKI. And again, I'm going to talk about ways you can use to differentiate between those entities, right? So basically, AKI, right, is essentially just an acute, basically depletion in a person's renal function, right? It's something that happens over like, a couple of hours to a couple of days, right? And I mean, the classic thing you obviously see clinically is that the patient's BUN, right, and the patient's creatinine will go up. Now, the thing is, AKI, right? I mean, you probably remember some of this from med school. There are three big types, right? There's like the pre-renal, and again, the easy way to understand this is just to understand the tubing, right? So, remember we have the afferent arterioles that feed blood to the kidneys. So if you have problems with that system, that will cause a pre-renal AKI. And then we have the kidney itself, right? If you have problems with that system, that's an intrarenal AKI. And then, remember, there's tubing that drains the kidneys, right? So, like, the ureters, the bladder, the urethra. If you have problems with that system, you have a post-renal AKI. And the truth is, of all these AKIs, I mean, you may see pre-renal quite a bit on exams, but actually, the most common one is actually intrarenal AKI, right? So, intrarenal AKI is actually the most common. The second most common is the pre-renal acute kidney injury, right? And then you can jump to the one that's the least common, which is the post-renal. And again, try to, because again, right, I know renal is classically like, people hear renal and they start to shudder, right? You don't need to shudder. Renal is fairly straightforward. Again, you just have to think. That's all you need to really do. So the thing is, if a person has intrarenal AKI, right, kind of think about the different components of the kidneys, right? So remember the kidneys, we have like the glomerulus, right? It's the thing that sort of filters stuff in the kidneys. And then the things that either secrete or reabsorb things in the kidneys are the tubules, right? And then remember that there's like renal parenchyma that surrounds the kidney tubules. Those are those classic things that we refer to as like the interstitium, right? It's almost like the extracellular matrix around the tubules of the kidneys. The reason I'm breaking it down that way is that if you sort of understand, that those are the three parts of the kidneys, then right off the bat, you already know three causes of intrarenal AKI. You can have a problem with the glomerulus. I will talk about that in another podcast. Those are your glomerulonephritides, right? So like IgA nephropathy, post-infectious glomerulonephritis, stuff like that, right? Alternatively, you can have problems with the kidney tubules themselves, right? That's like an acute tubular necrosis, right? Or alternatively, you can have problems with the extracellular matrix that surrounds the kidneys, the interstitium that surrounds the kidneys, right? So in that case, you know that you are likely dealing with acute interstitial nephritis. Remember, acute interstitial nephritis is that thing where classically on exams, you see this triad of like, this patient has a fever, they have a rash, they have elevated eosinophils either in their blood or in their urine. Yeah, on the USMLEs, that's usually the presentation you'll find. But on the medicine in training exam and the medicine boards, they are very unlikely to give you that classic presentation. So there are other things you may want to think about under those circumstances. So let's talk about these different AKIs one by one, right? So let's just go from the beginning to end. So let's talk about like the perirenal AKIs. So the thing is, in a perirenal AKI, you're not perfusing the kidney appropriately, right? You're not perfusing the kidney appropriately. I mean, it could mean that you may be volume down, right? So it's like, oh, you're just not sending enough blood. So let's say, for example, you were a trauma patient, you lost a ton of blood, you're volume down for that reason. Or let's say a person has like a very bad like gastroenteritis and they're vomiting a ton, right? That will also make them volume down, right? They won't perfuse the kidneys enough and they can have perirenal AKI symptoms. Another classic one on exams, right? So if you see me say the word exams, I'm referring to these medicine board exams especially. And step three, because again, you're going to see the stuff in step three, right? So so a person will have, if they're volume down for any reason, right? Like, again, like trauma patient that lost a ton of blood or gastroenteritis, a lot of vomiting, right? Those things can all cause problems, right? But another thing that can also happen is, what if you're not perfusing, like, because the thing is, think about it, you may have enough volume, but that volume may not be going in under like high pressures to the kidneys, right? They may not be going in under high pressures to the kidneys, right? So again, that can also cause problems with renal perfusion. And then another thing that may actually cause like a perirenal AKI, right? So kind of think about like a person that has like an acute CHF exacerbation, for example. If you have an acute CHF exacerbation, right, you may have a ton of volume on board, like you see like the peripheral edema and all that crap. But remember that those patients, right, their cardiac output is not great. So if your cardiac output is not great, guess you're essentially not sending enough blood into the aorta. If you're not sending enough blood into the aorta, then you will not be perfusing the kidneys appropriately, right? So if a person has like a decrease, like, I almost think of it as, I know in med school they used to call this effective arterial blood volume. If you have like a decreased effective arterial blood volume, right, that can cause a perirenal AKI, right? And the thing is, again, effective arterial blood volume means blood volume that is actively perfusing your organs, right? So if a person has CHF, yeah, they have a lot of volume on board, but it's not effectively perfusing their organs because the heart, the pump, is not working very well. That's one. Think of another person. Let's assume you have a patient with nephrotic syndrome, right? If a person has a nephrotic syndrome, they are peeing out a ton of protein, right? That protein, right, helps you maintain oncotic pressures in your vasculature, right? So if you have like hypoproteinemia, right, then you're not maintaining oncotic pressures. If you're not maintaining oncotic pressures, you also have a peripheral edema, right? So you won't have a decent effective arterial blood volume. Another weird one, if you want to sort of integrate the question with GI, is if a patient has a Ménétrier's disease, right? Remember, it's like the protein losing gastropathy, where they basically like poop out protein, right? If you have those problems, again, you'll have a decreased effective arterial blood volume, and those things will all cause you to hyperperfuse your kidneys, and you can get a perirenal AKI with that. So the thing is, obviously, you need to know the labs, right, that go along with a perirenal AKI. But let's sort of talk about the normal situation. Think about it. If you become volume down, right, if you're not perfusing your kidneys enough, your body is like, okay, you know what, I got to maintain GFR and I got to make sure that my kidneys don't die, right? So your body is like, okay, you know what, let me try to raise my not necessarily raise GFR, but maintain GFR. Because think about it, right, if you're not perfusing the kidneys in the first place, right, your GFR will go down, right? I mean, it's the amount of blood that's coming in through the afferent arterial and going into the glomerulus that determines your GFR. So if you're not perfusing your kidneys adequately, your GFR is low. But the thing is, your body likes this whole process of autoregulation, right? And in autoregulation, you essentially want to keep your, you essentially want to try to maintain some sort of homeostasis, right? So the way your body maintains homeostasis, right, is to keep your GFR in a constant balance. So if your GFR goes down because you're hypoperfusing the kidneys, your body will try to get it back up to just, again, keep it at a normal level, right? So how does your body accomplish that? And again, let's just, again, don't try to memorize anything. Just think about this logically. We know that the glomerulus is a capillary tuft that you find between the afferent arterial that lets blood arrive at the glomerulus. And then leading away from the glomerulus, you have the efferent arterial that helps blood exit the glomerulus, right? So the thing is, if you want your GFR to be if you want to like bring your GFR back up to normal, what you try to do is you will try to dilate the pipe that is bringing blood to your glomerulus, right? And you want to try to constrict the pipe that is getting blood out of your glomerulus, right? Because again, by doing those things, you will keep enough pressure of blood in the glomerulus, so your GFR will be maintained. So what is the thing that your body does to help with dilating the afferent arterial, which is the pipe that sends blood to your glomerulus? It uses prostaglandins, right? And then what's the thing your body uses to constrict the efferent arterial so that you have less blood leaving the glomerulus and you keep your GFR up to date? You do that with angiotensin too, right? So again, if you're not perfusing the kidneys, one, your body makes a ton of prostaglandin, and two, your renin angiotensin aldosterone system is kicked into high gear, right? And remember, your renin system starts at the level of the afferent arterial. You have your GG cells, right? So your juxtaglomerular cells, they make renin. That renin will convert angiotensinogen to angiotensin 1. And then that angiotensin 1 will go to the lungs. The endothelial cells that make up the lung capillaries have angiotensin converting enzyme. They'll convert that angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2. That angiotensin 2 will help you constrict your efferent arterial so that you stop draining blood away from the glomeruli. But another thing angiotensin 2 also does is it goes to the hypothalamus, right? So it goes to the supraoptic nucleus of the hypothalamus, and it helps you make ADH, antidiuretic hormone. As you'll see as I go along with this podcast, you see that antidiuretic hormone basically has two jobs. It helps you reabsorb water in the nephron, and it helps you reabsorb urea in the nephron. Okay. And then another thing angiotensin 2 also does is it goes to the adrenal cortex, right? So it goes to like your zona glomerulosa, right? That makes aldosterone. So it increases the production of aldosterone under those circumstances. So that's the normal way your body should respond, right? So if your volume down, let's say you're dehydrated or whatever, right? Your body will naturally respond by dilating your afferent arterial by increasing the production of prostaglandins and constricting your efferent arterial by producing more angiotensin 2 from this fancy schmancy renin angiotensin aldosterone system. Right. So if you really understand that pathophysiology, and again, let's kind of think about this. Let's maybe stretch this a little further. Right. So think about it. If your body is like volume down, right, it will make sense that your body will try to retain some of this volume. Right. Retain some of the sodium and all that stuff, because if you retain more sodium in your body, you'll be able to retain more volume, right? Because wherever sodium goes, water will follow. Right. Sodium is osmotically active. Also, the same thing with urea. Wherever urea goes, water would follow. Although it's, if you really think about it on the step one level of detail, it's actually wherever the water goes, urea follows. But that's a different story for step one, and that's not specifically the purpose of this podcast. So, right, if your renin angiotensin aldosterone system is all revved up, right, you can already see that a person's urine sodium, because remember aldosterone, right, one of the things it does is it reabsorbs, it increases the reabsorption of sodium in the gut, in the nephron, right, like the distal nephron. So if you have your renin angiotensin aldosterone system all revved up, you reabsorb more sodium in your nephron, right? So your urine sodium, the amount of sodium that makes its way to the urine that you collect like in a cup or whatever, should be really low. Right, that's why usually if a person has a pre-renal AKI, their urinary sodium is usually pretty low. It's usually less than 20 on these exams. And then another thing you want to keep at the back of your mind, right? It's like if a person is reabsorbing, because again, remember, one of the byproducts of the renin angiotensin aldosterone system kicking into high gear is ADH, right? If you have high levels of ADH, remember, ADH literally means antidiuretic hormone. So it prevents you from diuresing. So you also reabsorb a lot of water in the distal nephron. So if you're reabsorbing a ton of water in the distal nephron, guess what will happen to your urine osmolality? It will get, your urine will get more concentrated, right? Because it doesn't have as much water in it, right? So your urine will get super, super, super concentrated. So usually, if a patient has a pre-renal AKI on these exams, their urine osmolality is usually greater than like 500, for example, right? And then, whenever you're, just to kind of make your life easy, your urinary sodium and your fractional excretion of sodium kind of go in the same direction. If your urinary sodium is low, what should be true of your fractional excretion of sodium? your fractional excretion of sodium should also be low, right? So usually on these exams, the FeNA, right, the fractional excretion of sodium is usually less than 1% if a person has a pre-renal AKI, right? And again, I said again, ADH goes up, right, as a result of activation of the renin-angiotensin aldosterone system. So yes, your urine gets more concentrated, right? But you also begin to pee out less urea because, again, ADH increases the reabsorption of urea, right? So your fractional excretion of urea in a person that has a perinatal AKI will actually be less than 35%, okay? So these are numbers you sort of kind of want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And I mean, one roundabout way your friends that write these tests can try to trick you is instead of showing you that, oh, the urine osmolality is high, so greater than 500 in a perirenal AKI, they may just give you the specific gravity of urine, right? They may give you like a specific gravity that's like 1.020 or 1.030, some really high number. Remember, specific gravity is a measure of density, is a measure of relative density, right? So if your urine specific gravity is elevated, right? So if it's like a number that's kind of like north of 1.012, right, like significantly north of 1.012, that tells you that you're dealing with urine that is super concentrated, okay? So you're very likely dealing with a pre-renal AKI kind of situation. So again, to summarize, your urine osmolarity will be high. It'll be greater than 500. Your fractional excretion of sodium will be low. It'll be less than 1%. Your fractional excretion of urea will be low. It'll be less than 35%. Your urine sodium will be low. It'll be less than 20. Okay, these are all things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And you may say, okay, Divine, it doesn't make any sense. Why am I measuring the FeNA? I mean, why am I measuring like the fractional excretion of sodium and also measuring the fractional excretion of urea? So the reason I'm actually mentioning both quantities is that your friends that write these tests can actually introduce a small curveball in the Q-STEM. So they may describe a person that has perirenal AKI, right? And then they tell you that this person is on diuretics. Right? If a person is on diuretics, remember diuretics, right? Like your loop diuretics, they block sodium reabsorption. Your thiazide diuretics, they block sodium reabsorption, right? So the thing is, your diuretics actually falsely elevate your fractional excretion of sodium, right? So the thing is, under those circumstances, a better surrogate for pre-renal AKI is actually to measure the fractional excretion of urea, okay? If it's less than 35%, that tells you you're dealing with a pre-renal AKI, right? And the thing is, if you sort of step back to the pathophys I described earlier, right? So what are the certain things that can cause pre-renal AKI, for example, right? Like, think about it. I just said that under normal circumstances, your body says, you know what? Let me dilate the pipe that leads to the glomerulus. Let me dilate the afferent arterial. And I said that the thing that makes that happen is your prostaglandins. So guess what? If a person takes an NSAID, right, and they are volume depleted, can you begin to see how that could potentially cause or trigger or worsen a perirenal AKI? Well, I hope you're saying yes to that, right? Because classically, those people will have, because by giving an NSAID, right? So like ibuprofen, for example, your NSAIDs inhibit cyclooxygenase. So if you inhibit cyclooxygenase, your prostaglandin levels will go down. So you will no longer dilate the afferent arterial. If anything, you would constrict the afferent arterial and then you get into trouble. Alternatively, if a person is in the hospital, right, and their volume down, they're super sick, it probably makes sense to maybe stop their ACE inhibitor or their ARB, because those ACE inhibitors and ARBs, they basically blunt the effects of angiotensin II. So under those circumstances, you will no longer be able to constrict that efferent arterial. If anything, you dilate the efferent arterial. So under those circumstances, again, you can trigger or worsen AKI, okay, a perirenal AKI. So just sort of keep that at the back of your mind. And then one thing I just want you to remember that goes with perirenal AKI is the BUN to creatinine ratio. The BUN to creatinine ratio is usually greater than 20 in patients that have a perirenal AKI. The thing is, there are mechanisms behind why the BUN to creatinine is greater than 20. But that is a big discussion that is probably more relevant to a person that's taking the USMLE Step 1 exam. So I'm going to move on. Basically, the Cliff's Notes version is you're reabsorbing BUN faster than you're reabsorbing creatinine in the nephron. So, but again, there's a lot of stuff there. I really don't want to spend time going into that now. So I'm just going to keep going. And just right off the bat, to kind of make your life easy, I think it's kind of like important and helpful to be able to distinguish numbers-wise between prerenal AKI and intrarenal AKI, right? So I said in prerenal AKI, your FeNA, your fractional excretion of sodium, is less than 1%. In intrarenal AKI, it's usually greater than 2%, right? Prerenal AKI, I said that the fractional excretion of urea is usually less than 35%. For intrarenal, that number is like 50 to 60%. I'll just sort of take a number in the middle, like 55%. If it's more than 55%, you're thinking more about an intrarenal AKI. And then I said that the urinary sodium, right, is usually like less than 20 in a patient that has a prerenal AKI. That number you want to think about for an intrarenal AKI is a number greater than 40. Urinary sodium greater than 40, think about an intrarenal AKI. And then the last value I guess I can talk about is this whole business with the BUN to creatinine ratio. The BUN to creatinine ratio is usually greater than 20 in a prerenal AKI, but it's usually less than 20 in an intrarenal AKI, okay? Because you have no ability to reabsorb the urea nitrogen, or now I think about it again. It's a big lecture. It's a probably like a 10-minute explanation to explain why your BUN to creatinine. So let me just say this way. If you have any questions on this, like, oh, Divine, why is the BUN to creatinine higher than or whatever? Just let me know, or maybe go back and listen to the renal podcast I have for step one. I'm fairly certain I talk about the pathophys behind that there. So I'm just going to keep going. So in an intrarenal AKI, BUN to creatinine is less than 20. In prerenal AKI, it's greater than 20, right? And then the urine osmolality, I said, greater than 500 for prerenal AKI. It's usually less than like 350 in an intrarenal AKI, right? Because the thing is, your kidney is an organ that if your volume down or whatever, right? Or if you have like some kind of disease, your kidney is like an organ that helps with concentrating your urine. So if your kidneys are dead, like your kidney tubules are dead, right? Like in an intrarenal AKI kind of situation, you will not really have the ability to concentrate your urine appropriately. Well, guess what? If you cannot concentrate your urine appropriately, your urine osmolality will closely approximate your serum osmolality. And your serum osmolality is usually around like 280, 300, right? So your urine osmolality is usually less than 350 if a person has an intrarenal AKI. And I mean, if you really do think about it, right, if a person has, I guess, if you're kind of like doing a urinalysis, and I will spend some time talking about like the urinalysis, maybe at the end of this podcast, or maybe like in the next podcast that I go into for the medicine board exams. But basically, usually if a person has like a prerenal AKI, their urine usually has like hyaline casts, right? So essentially, if you're dehydrated for any cause for like a prolonged period of time, you'll have hyaline casts in your urine. It's something that contains, if you remember from step one, the classically described TAM horsephore protein, okay? Those are the things that constitute like, they're just like pinkish casts. They're the hyaline casts you find in the urine in people that are dehydrated. So you potentially find in a person that has a prerenal AKI. And then intrarenal AKI, Moody Brown cast, right? And again, there are many different terms that they use on these exams to describe Moody Brown cast. Because if you think about it, how can you make an exam harder than it should be? You can take what a person knows and just put it in different terms. So instead of seeing the Moody Brown cast, you may see granular casts, right? Like brown granular casts, or they may tell you pigmented granular casts. If you see those things, you want to think more about an intrarenal AKI, right? More specifically, you want to think about an acute tubular necrosis. So I think that's all I want to say about a prerenal AKI. So let me sort of jump to the intrarenal AKI business. The first thing I guess I will start with is that really the most common cause of an intrarenal AKI, believe it or not, is prerenal AKI, okay? Prerenal AKI is actually the most common cause of intrarenal AKI, right? Because the thing is, as time goes on, as time goes on, if your volume down, volume down, volume down, again, yeah, your kidney can auto-regulate all it wants, right? But the thing is, you cannot, I almost sort of think of it this way, right? Like, oh, if the economy is bad, I'll go into austerity measures. And let's say, oh, you know what? I have only $10,000 in my bank account. Well, guess what? $10,000 cannot last forever. At some point, you will run out of money. And when you run out of money, then you may, I don't know, die of hunger or something weird, right? So that's kind of like the thing that happens. If you have perianal AKI for a long enough period of time, you can then degenerate to having an intrarenal AKI, right? And I mean, what are the things that can cause... in fact, if you sort of think about it, like many things that cause like a perianal AKI can cause an intrarenal AKI, right? So say, for example, like contrast nephropathy. Many people think, oh, contrast just kills the kidneys. Yeah, it does that, but there's other things that contrast does for the most part. One thing contrast actually has the ability to do is it can actually cause a constriction of your afferent arterial, right? So blood will not arrive at the glomerulus, right? So that's kind of like replicating prerenal physiology under those circumstances, right? So again, many of the things that can cause a prerenal AKI can ultimately cause an intrarenal AKI, right? So what are the big things that can cause the intrarenal AKI? So basically acute tubular necrosis, right? Again, perianal AKI that has gone untreated, right? Over time, your kidney will run out of autoregulatory measures, right? And your tubules will then die from like ischemia, right? Because your GFR is not high enough. Another classic one, right? So they can give you like a person that, I don't know, like is like an alcoholic and they pass out for like 18 hours. Or it can be a person, let's say it's an old, like 80-something year old person that falls down and cannot get up, and then they're stuck on the floor for a long time. Or let's say you have a person that suffers like a crush injury in trauma, or a person that just ran like a heavy marathon, and let's say maybe they didn't train wisely, or they've never really run a marathon before, right? And then they tell you that, oh, this person's creatinine is like super high, right? And then they tell you that, oh, you check the blood. You check their urine and you have like 4+ blood in the urine on dipstick, right? But then they tell you like, man, I'm looking under the microscope. I'm only seeing like 1 or 2 red blood cells, right? It's like what you're seeing on dipstick does not appear to be agreeing with what you see on a urine microscopy. If you see that, you really want to think about rhabdomyolysis, right? Rhabdomyolysis. And again, rhabdomyolysis, the thing is, your friends that write these exams, they love to test many things relating to rhabdo, right? So again, I've talked about the classic presentations, but what are some associated things you can see in rhabdo on an exam, right? They can give you the electrolyte abnormalities, right? So if, for example, they give you like a prolonged QT interval in a person that has rhabdo, right? You want to think about hypocalcemia, because those dead muscle cells, they begin to sequester the calcium intracellularly, right? So you can get EKG antecedents that go with hypocalcemia. Probably the one that's more commonly tested is hyperkalemia. Because remember, if you remember from, again, you're studying in med school or whatever, remember that your potassium is an intracellular ion, right? Because of the activity of the sodium potassium ATPase pump, right? So that pump, it gets 3 sodiums out of cells. So sodium is primarily extracellular, and it dumps 2 potassiums into cells. So your potassium is primarily intracellular. So if your muscle cells burst open, right, they die, right, all their intracellular soup will spill out into the circulation, like potassium, right? And that can cause hyperkalemia. So you can see like the tall peak T waves, you can see the white QRS, right? Again, if you're seeing those EKG findings, you probably want to start doing those fancy schmancy calcium gluconate, insulin with glucose, right? You want to start giving like KX-late, right? Stuff like that. You want to give like a diuretic and all that crap, right? And again, rhabdo, I mean, obviously for rhabdo, you're going to hydrate, right? Like normal saline, give a crap ton of normal saline to flush that myoglobin flush that myoglobin through the nephron, right? And I mean, something that I guess is sort of kind of closely related to this whole rhabdo business is not exactly rhabdo, but it can present like rhabdo. Are two other things, right? So say, for example, they can give you a person that has like a hematologic malignancy, right? And they're undergoing like chemo, right? And then you have a ton of cancer cells dying all at once. Remember, if you remember from, again, med school, the urea cycle, right, happens inside cells, right? So not necessarily the urea cycle, I take that back. But you have a ton of DNA, right, inside cells. And DNA synthesis, for the most part, happens like in the cell soup, right? So if you spill out, if a lot of cancer cells are dying, remember, cancer cells reproduce like crazy. So you have a ton of DNA. all that DNA, right, contains like purines and all that stuff. So you can already see where I'm going with this, right? The person can have like a ton of uric acid, so they can have like a urate nephropathy, right? So hopefully you're thinking like, you know what, maybe I should have given that person allopurinol or febuxostat or like a uricase analog, right? Like piglotticase or asboricase to prevent that urate nephropathy. Another one can also be a person that has like really bad a really bad hemolysis, right? So let's say a person has they have like a bad hemolytic crisis, a lot of red blood cells are dying, right? Remember, red blood cells, they release a crap ton of hemoglobin into the circulation. That hemoglobin, you can actually have such a thing as a hemoglobin nephropathy. Okay, so just sort of keep that at the back of your mind. But again, the bulk of the question they will give you more clues, right? So like you may see the elevated LDH, the low haptoglobin, you may do a blood smear and see like the schistocytes, right, telling you that you're maybe dealing with a hemolytic process, or they may give you something relating to like an indirect hyperbilirubinemia, right? Those are all clues that can lead you down those directions. So again, all these things, right, can cause essentially like an intrarenal AKI. And then, I mean, other things that can cause an intrarenal AKI, right? So your drugs, right? So like your aminoglycosides, right? So like your gentamicin, your tobramycin in a CF patient, right? Your amikacin, right? That used for like very bad resistant gram-negative infections, right? Those things can all cause an AKI. And don't forget your amphoterol, right? So if they give you a question about like a diabetic, right, that is like in DK or whatever, and then they are beginning to have like their face like turned dark, right, and they have like severe sinus pain and pressure and tenderness, you may be thinking about like mucormycosis under those circumstances. Remember, for those people, you want to debreed a ton and then give amphoterol, right? So amphotericin B. That thing is super, super nephrotoxic, right? That's why you usually give the liposomal formulation. And then don't forget, like, if a person is getting like a platinum agent, like cisplatin, right? Cisplatin, remember, cisplatin is a very, very nasty drug. It's super, super, super nephrotoxic, right? And usually hemonc doctors try to give this drug. It's known as amifostine. So amifostine. To sort of like decrease the incidence of the nephropathy that's associated with taking a cisplatin, right? Remember, cisplatin is nephro and ototoxic. There are three high yield drugs for exams that you want to keep at the back of your mind that are nephro and ototoxic. Four high yield drugs. One is cisplatin. Cisplatin is nephro and ototoxic. The next one is vancomycin. Vancomycin is nephro and ototoxic. The third one are your aminoglycosides, right? Like your gentamicin, neomycin, amikacin, tobramycin. Those drugs are also nephro and ototoxic. And then the fourth one is a loop diuretic that you give to people that have sulfur allergies, ethacrynic acid. Ethacrynic acid is nephro and ototoxic as well, okay? So those are four high-yield drugs you want to keep at the back of your mind. Aminoglycosides, vancomycin, cisplatin, and ethacrynic acid. Remember, ethacrynic acid is a loop diuretic. Okay, so those things can all cause ATN, right? And then also don't forget, right, AIN is an example of intrarenal AKI, right? So acute interstitial nephritis. So again, you're used to the fever, rash, eosinophilia, blah, 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 right? Again, those things, even in the real world, they are found in very few people. It's like maybe like 20-30% of people that have AIN end up having that triad of fever, rash, and elevated eosinophils in their blood and in their urine. Although I will tell you that even if you don't necessarily find it that way in the real world, on USMLE exams, right, step 1, 2CK, step 3, whatever, that is the classic presentation of AIN, okay? So those are things you want to keep at the back of your mind, right? So AIN, you'll see that triad, but what are the things that cause AIN, right? So usually on exams, they're drugs, right? Classic poster child drugs are like your cephalosporins, right? Like, or your basically like your beta-lactams. Those things can cause AIN, right? And those are the ones where classically you'll see like the elevated eosinophils in the blood or the elevated eosinophils in the urine, right? But the thing is, there are actually certain drugs that can cause AIN where you may not necessarily see elevated eosinophils in the blood or in the urine, right? So this is one that is probably more attuned to the medicine in training exam or the medicine board exam. And again, this is where you want to pay attention. This is like floridly high yield. But your NSAIDs, right, like your ibuprofen, your ketorolac, or your PPIs, right, your PPIs, right, so like your omeprazole and all that stuff that people get like candy in the hospital, those drugs, they can cause AIN, but they may not necessarily give you the eosinophilia or the eosinophiluria, okay? So those are things you want to keep at the back of your mind. Believe it or not, again, you may see, Divine, you're being a little too specific. Again, I promise you, I have a lot of experience with these exams. I promise you, those are high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind, right? Or they may give you an African-American female that has like shortness of breath and bilateral hilar lymphadenopathy on a chest x-ray. That's sarcoidosis, right? Sarcoidosis actually has a pretty strong association with AIN. Or they may describe a patient that has like a gritty feeling in their eyes and they have like dry mouth and their secretions, like they're having like a painful intercourse, right? Because their vaginal secretions are very like not, let me just say, they're not fluidy enough, right? You're thinking about Sjogren's. Remember, Sjogren's has that very strong association, right? Remember, Sjogren's has a bunch of weird associations on exams. It has the association with AIN, right? That's one. Another thing Sjogren's has an association with is your type 1 RTA, right? So like the distal RTAs, right? The distal renal tubular acidosis, those have an association with Sjogren's syndrome, right? So those are like kind of like weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind with Sjogren's. And then remember, if a woman is pregnant and it is they tell you that, oh, she delivers a kid that has like complete heart block, right? Also think about Sjogren's with that, right? Sjogren's, those anti-Rho and anti-La antibodies can cross the placenta and destroy the conducting system in the fetus. Us, right, that can cause a third degree or complete heart block. Okay, and I mean, I already kind of talked about how contrast can cause a AKI, right? So they may describe a person that, oh, this person recently got a cardiac cath or whatever, right? Or this person got like imaging for a PE or whatever, and then they tell you like a day or two later their creatinine is going up. Under those circumstances, you want to think about a contrast nephropathy, right? And I mean, obviously, for a person to, how can you prevent contrast nephropathy? Give a ton of fluids, right? So fluids. Give a ton of like normal saline before they get the contrast, and a ton of saline after they get the contrast. Throwback to people that, if you remember, like the stuff you learned in med school about like N-acetylcysteine. There's really not good data for N-acetylcysteine, to be perfectly honest. So usually that is the wrong answer on exams. The best means of preventing contrast nephropathy on any of these tests is to give fluids. If you don't see fluids and none of the other answers make sense, then you can go ahead and pick a N-acetylcysteine and usually give a pretty high dose. Because I mean, N-acetylcysteine is a harmless drug, doesn't really cause many side effects. So take that for what you will. But usually N-acetylcysteine is the wrong answer on exams. Right. But one, I guess another thing I want to sort of want to throw your way. Right. So what if a person recently had a cardiac, recently had like a cardiac cath. Right. And then they tell you that it's like, you know, like 4 or 5 days after, you're beginning to notice that the person's like creatinine is beginning to rise and you're seeing like purple rashes on their lower extremities and their toes look necrotic. What are you thinking about? I hope you're thinking about like an embolic cause, basically, of this person's AKI, right? So remember, after cardiac cath, right, as you're cathing the bad coronary artery, you can essentially shoot out emboli. You can shoot out emboli to many parts of the body, right? So those people, they can have like embolic phenomena in the lower extremities. So you may see like the classically described livido reticularis, right? So like purple rash, net-like appearance in the lower extremities. Think about livido reticularis. Those people, they may actually have like eosinophilia. So the thing that your friends that write these exams try to do is they may try to make you confuse this with acute interstitial nephritis. Don't fall for that. People that have AIN, it will usually be like some kind of drug exposure that sort of triggered that. and they would not have like necrotic extremities, and they would not have the livido reticularis. Okay, so if you see like elevated eosinophils in the blood or in the urine, and you're seeing like necrotic extremities after like a procedure that may have potentially disengaged, like I don't know, like cholesterol plaques or something, think about embolic phenomena. It can cause an EKI, believe it or not. It can cause like people can get strokes, people can get like leg ischemia, right, from all these things, right? And classically, again, on labs, you'll find the elevated eosinophils. Another thing you may also find is like low C3 and C4. So your complement proteins may be low, okay? For those people, in general, again, this is usually like a hard clinical decision, because many of the people that have these problems, they need to be on anticoagulation. But the thing is, for these people, if, for example, they have no real need for anticoagulation, it may seem paradoxical, but that's actually the right thing to do. You want to go ahead and stop anticoagulation in patients that have these embolic problems after like cardiac cath, okay? So it may not be a cardiac cath question, it may be another like kind of like vascular whatever, but if they have no real indication for anticoagulation, you want to go ahead and stop it, okay? Because again, it's kind of paradoxical, and again, I don't have the time to explain why that is the case. I mean, this podcast is already almost 41 minutes, so that's something to keep at the back of your mind. It's just one of those weird things where it's something that people don't think about, but it's actually the right thing to do. And then I guess to kind of round off here, I don't know, I feel like this has gone on for long. You know what, let me go ahead and stop here. So hopefully with this you feel good about AKI in general, and again, these things are very heavily tested on step 3, the medicine in training exam, the medicine boards, okay? And as I do when I end any podcast, so I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams. So step 1, 2CS, 2CK, step 3. And then like the internal medicine in training exam and the internal medicine board exams. I've actually tutored a ton of people for those tests. And then if you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERASAP, or a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCASAP, I do offer like one-on-one advising and I guess consulting, if you may call that. For those indications, and again, if you're a college student and you need tutoring in like biochemistry, physics, general chemistry, organic chemistry, physiology, histology, all that stuff, I do offer tutoring for those. I have a lot of experience. Just reach out to me and I can give you some more details. You can either reach out to me through the website, or you can send me an email at Divine Intervention podcast with an S at the end at gmail.com. So have a wonderful rest of your weekend. God bless you. I'll see you in the next podcast. Thank you.